TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. When Pandemics Changed History, Richard Wolff and Alan Brown. Professor Richard Wolff just finished another book. The subtitle is When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics, or Itself. Longtime critic of the private, for-profit banking system, Alan Brown, campaigns to return control of money and credit to states, cities, and communities. She invited Richard Wolff to an interview on Zoom on December 17, 2020. The 30-minute conversation is archived on the YouTube channel of the Public Banking Institute, founded in 2011 by Alan Brown. She's an attorney and author of the book Web of Debt. Suzanne O'Keefe, Communications Coordinator for the Public Banking Institute, introduced the live event.
Welcome, everybody, to PBI Live. History tells us that pandemics precede huge radical shifts in society and economic systems. The Black Death, for example, was the beginning of the end of feudalism. Today, we are very honored to have Professor Richard Wolff join us with PBI Chair Alan Brown to discuss what those radical breaks of the past can show us and consider what seismic changes we might expect for ourselves now. Also, how public banks could play a positive role. Professor Wolff, who needs no introduction, but briefly is Professor of Economics Emeritus, UMass Amherst, and a visiting professor of the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. Welcome, Professor Wolff and Alan Brown, our PBI chair. I will turn it over to you.
Professor Rick, it's great to be talking to you again.
Same here, Ellen. I really look forward to those times when our paths cross.
Thank you. You're an expert, not just in economics, but in history. And you have delved into the history of epidemics as you've covered that in your latest book. I wondered if you could just go into the history of epidemics and how they have triggered or influenced economic and political change.
Sure. First of all, and this is so often forgotten, viruses have been part of the natural environment of human beings from the beginning, however many thousand years back the beginning may be. Viruses have come in a variety of sorts. Some of them have been minimally destructive, and some of them have been massive. Much attention has been given recently to the history 100 years ago in 1918, to be precise, when we had a terrible flu epidemic here in the United States, likewise a virus. It got the name Spanish flu. It had nothing particular to do with Spain, mostly because the Spanish media were not so censored, so they actually told their people about the virus, whereas in most other countries, including the United States, information was hidden because of the fear of panic and the fear of those in power that it would be used against them in some sense. Because there's a guilty recognition, which I'm gonna come back to later in our conversation. There's a guilty recognition that one of the things that you judge a social arrangement by, its politics, its economics, is how well it does something as fundamental as protect public health. That is a requirement. And a system or a society that fails to do that, as ours now has done, is a society that's going to change because, however long it takes, it sinks into the consciousness of people that the system they live in was unable or unwilling to prepare itself for and to contain a disease that keeps coming. So the history is viruses are always there. Viruses can be very destructive. You don't have to go back even 100 years. Within the last 20 years, we've had MERS and SARS and Ebola. I mean, the risk of damaging deadly viruses is reinforced in everybody who pays any attention to this over and over. What this means is that any decent society has to be prepared for a virus. You don't know exactly when it's going to come, but it is going to come. And so you have to have ready what you know may be able to save you from it. Tests, masks, gloves, hospital units, ventilators, the whole apparatus, again, well known. We have all those things in the United States, or to be more accurate, we have the ability to produce them. We have the machinery, we have the raw materials, we have the labor, it's all there, but we didn't produce it. Even now, 9 months into this catastrophe, there's still shortages of these kinds of things all over the United States, having devastating effects on the pandemic. So for me, the first lesson of history is, how in the world can you explain, given what I've said, the lack of preparation? It blows your mind. And when you add to that, that once it hit and we weren't prepared, we have now failed to contain it. We are coming up on, if my numbers are correct, 300,000 dead people in our society because we haven't been able to organize the control and the breaking down of transmission. And there are plenty of countries over the last 9 months that have done this work much, much better than the United States. There are countries like Cuba and Vietnam, left wing, if you like, but there are also countries like Taiwan and Australia, which are on the right end of the range, if you like. In all these societies, something enabled their government and their private sectors to coordinate, to mobilize all the resources necessary. China, for example, the People's Republic of China, has 4 times the population of the United States, 4 times, and it has 4,000 dead from corona. We have almost 300,000. Numbers like that destroy all rationalizations, all spin, there it stands, and something has to be accommodated historically. The second way, and then I'll stop so I don't talk so long. The second historical thing was what Suzanne referred to in her introduction. In the 14th century, we had a spectacular disease sweeping Europe called the Black Death, the bubonic plague. If I understand correctly, that was more bacterial, it was not viral, but the effect was the same. It spread death. The estimates are 500 million people died, a third of the population of Europe at the time. Serfs and lords, because it was feudalism, died, were rendered ill. Feudal manors stopped functioning. I would contend, and there are much historical evidence for this, that European feudalism, what replaced slavery with the collapse of Rome in the 5th century, by the time of the 14th century, feudalism was already in trouble. People were exhausted. They didn't know how to make the soil rich enough to continue to produce. People were weakened in their bodily constitutions, so this disease could ravage them. But they figured out in the next century or two, it took a while, that feudalism had failed. Feudalism could not save 500 million. One out of three people in Europe from a very awful, horrible, painful death. And the system never recovered. The mass of people simply backed away. That's why the Renaissance and the Reformation and the end of feudalism was, in a sense, set up by the collapse, the colossal failure of this system to save people from something like a disease. My argument would be, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb here, we are going to be looking back on what we are going through now, COVID-19, the latest in a series of viruses called the corona type of virus, which epidemiologists have been saying for years threaten us, have been urging us to take the steps which weren't taken to prepare for what this virus could do. This is not a disease we could not have prepared for. This is a disease that our economic and political system did not know how to cope with. And so it pretended that somehow the danger wasn't there. A little bit like a child scared by a dog that's threatening, puts his or her fingers in front of her eyes and can't see it for a moment, and thinks that because he or she can't see it, it isn't there. You know, when we grow up, we realize it's still there when you can't see it. We didn't do that as a society. And all the denial in the world isn't going to make this fundamental fact that the capitalist system we live in said to the companies that exist, who could have produced the masks, the gloves, the ventilators, you could have produced them, you know how. You could have stored them and stockpiled them in warehouses all across this country so they were there and ready to help the populations in danger. And you would have had to wait in those warehouses with those stockpiles for however many years it took for the next dangerous virus. And the capitalists of America made a decision, which I understand, it's how capitalism works, that investment is too risky. How many years do you wait? Too expensive to put your money into all of this sitting in warehouses. They're not going to do that. So they found less risky, more profitable investments elsewhere. And that's what they did. And that's why we're not prepared with what we would have needed to get through this. This is a failure of capitalist enterprises, because the knowledge we had, the reasonable explanation or expectation we had, this is a system failure. And I believe it is slowly but steadily sinking into the consciousness, and therefore history will likely be repeated in the sense that, like feudalism never got past the failure of the Black Death, we are unlikely to see capitalism erase the history of its own failure here in the United States, but I have to say also in Western Europe and in several other places. There is really no way out of that dilemma.
Okay, well, you could argue that it serves the big corporate capitalists. They want, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. Right. They want to get rid of the small businesses. That's the capitalism on which America was founded, you know, small farmers, little businesses, everybody had their own business. That was a good thing where they competed fairly. But now what we have is big corporate capitalism, where the rich have obviously gotten richer in this crisis, and the poor or the small businesses have gotten wiped out. And the laws have allowed this to happen by saying that Walmart is an essential service, but your little local store, your little local restaurant is not, or you know, Amazon is essential service, and they've obviously profited hugely off the whole thing. So it does look to me like where the little capitalists are getting wiped out, the big capitalists are taking over, and this is, so we're likely to have a stronger corporate capitalism than we had before. And so my question would be, how do we get out of this mess? How do we restore justice for the little businesses and the individuals?
Okay, let's take two or three of them and look at them a little bit. First, let's deal with the solution that is, in a sense, the most immediately obvious. The United States government, I'm going to use the United States as my example. The United States government had exactly the same problem that I just described with healthcare and where it was failed to be prepared for the pandemic. It has exactly the same problem, you may be surprised to know, with the defense industry, the military. See, it turns out that for a private producer, private company, to make a gun or a missile or a tank or a fighter aircraft or any of those things, and then produce it and put it somewhere and monitor it and take care of it the way a mask would have to be monitored and stockpiled, or a ventilator, or a hospital. You have the same problem with the military. What are you going to do? Make it, stick it in a warehouse, pay all the expenses of holding it, and for how long? Who knows when the next war is going to come? It's like a virus. You don't know when. So it turns out that we wouldn't have guns and ships and planes and missiles and tanks if we left it to the private capitalist the way we left our healthcare. Wow, so what did we do? We solved the problem. Here's what happens. The government comes in and says to the producers of missiles and guns, we will buy every missile, we will buy every gun as fast as it comes off the assembly line. You don't have to worry, no risk. We make the deal in advance. We have the government, the Congress give us, as they did this last week, a big ton of money, $750 billion to be precise. And now we can make a contract. We can promise you this money as you deliver to us the tank and the missile. Then the government uses our tax money to stockpile it, to secure it, to replace it, to clean it, to watch it. How long? For as long as it takes, until the next military event requires us to use it. So you have no risk anymore. So the real question becomes, why was that not done for the things we need to secure public health? And it becomes really poignant when you have the following fact in your brain. We're coming up on 300,000 dead people this year from COVID. That's more people than most of the wars this country has been involved in. That's more Americans dead from COVID than were killed by all those wars. So if you believe in the sanctity of human life, which I do hear quite a bit, well, then what's the excuse? The answer is there is no excuse. The reason the government didn't step in is that the four industries that govern our healthcare, doctors, hospitals, drug and device makers, and medical insurers, those four industries have gotten together and they operate what should be called the medical industrial complex. It's the parallel to the military industrial complex, but it's in healthcare. But here's the crucial difference. Everyone who pays any attention knows that in most other countries in the world, they have a nationalized health system with some private, by all means, but it's basically one uniform system, usually managed and governed by the government pretty tightly. Even Canada and Britain, countries close to us, have that. We are unique. And that is not unrelated with the fact that we pay more for healthcare than any other developed country, and there's nobody even close. So we have a private system that is really raking in the big bucks, and the big fear they have is what? Socialized medicine, that the government will come in and create a Medicare for all, as was discussed over the last couple of years and over the last two presidential campaigns. We have to get over that, because the easiest solution to never let this happen again is for the government to do for healthcare what it already does for the military. That's the first. There's a second solution I can give you that's different, which is to understand, and if this is radical, so be it, to understand that nowhere is it written and nowhere is it appropriate in economics to imagine something so dogmatic and so destructive as the idea, quote, that everything is better handled by a market than by some other system. I mean, that is the crudest form of fundamentalism. It's as if, you know, the only way to be religious is to go and do a particular religion in a particular way. We're tolerant. We pride ourselves that there's lots of different ways to be religious, and we're happy that we let people find their own way. Well, what in the world is making us think that everything is handled privately best with a market? There are a lot of things that aren't. We as a society have supported the idea that education is something we provide for everyone at public expense. We're not going to sell access. You know, you're not going to pay more so that your child sits in the front of the classroom because the other child has less money and has to buy a seat, and that we don't do any of that. Well, why in the world do we want it with medical care? That ought to be part of the national debate.
Okay, I'm good with that. For me, is what do we do now? We've got all these small businesses that are out of business and people who are out of work. So I'll just put in a couple of plugs for public banking. You're on the advisory board, which is great. So I'm sure you can say this as well. But right now there's a National Infrastructure Bank bill at HR 6422. That would put millions of people back to work. It's basically doing what Roosevelt did, and it would cost the federal government nothing. And so, you know, we're all about that because that's a big public national infrastructure bank. And then local public banks would help as well, because the big banks just are not lending to small businesses because they don't know what the future holds. They're afraid they're going to be lending to bankrupt businesses, et cetera. But a public bank, A, would be mandated to lend to small businesses, and B, they have lower costs, so they can actually do it. You know, they don't have shareholders that bleed out the profits. They don't have high-paid CEOs, so they can still break even. I mean, maybe not turn a great profit, but they don't need to turn a profit because they're a public institution. Anyway, could you just comment briefly on what do we do now for the small businesses that are out of business? I mean, these desperate people that have been shut down, and right next door is some big supermarket that's been left open. You know, it's very upsetting to these people.
Absolutely. It's outrageous. And let me drive home the point, and then we'll talk about public banking. In most of the European countries, almost all of them, they did not do what we did in this country. Americans have to face up to this. We are going through a terrible illness, a terrible scourge, a pandemic. That's more than enough to cope with. But we allowed, on top of that, massive unemployment. Over 60 million Americans have filed for unemployment compensation since March of this year. They're not all still on unemployment. They were able to get some jobs, some of them, although we still have 20, 25 million at least that are unemployed. But this was unspeakable. You added to people's misery during a pandemic the anxiety of not having a job, not having an income, not knowing whether the job would be there whenever this pandemic is over. I mean, the cruelty of doing that on top of a pandemic is what made Europeans not do it. In Europe, the simple basic response was the government will come in, and it said to the small business, you keep the people on the payroll. We will pick up between 70 and 90% of the payroll that you pay out to your employees in your little businesses, precisely that everything stays. The workers have to go home for the disease, but they don't have to deal with that. Job is theirs. It will come back. We will carry this system through the pandemic. Why we didn't do that in the United States is a question I won't answer, but I hope most of the people watching and listening can figure that out. Now, a public banking system. The whole point of a public banking system, in my mind, is to do precisely what the private banks don't do, but what we can see society needs. And you just laid out what our society these days needs. It obviously needs institutions, preferably local, that know what the small business crisis is, know what it means, and can step in with the credit and the understanding and the forbearance, not to cash in on a loan that's due, not to withhold credit that will get people through a difficult time. Let me remind you of an old financial rule that big business never remembers. When you economize on labor and you get rid of your little business competitor, you know what you're destroying? Your market. So I would enthusiastically endorse this is the right time for people to be told, people to be urged to understand. The biggest banks in this country are part of what got us here. They're not the solution. They are the problem. The solution is to open up banking and to do what banking should always have done. Be a public service. Take the needs of the community and find the credit, the financial wherewithal to get them done. Private bank can't afford to look at it that way, but a public bank chartered by the public, responsible to the public, it could and it would, and that's why it's a better way to go. I felt this way in the crisis of 2008. I remember having a meeting with credit unions, and I remember thinking, this is your moment. Everybody's angry at the big banks. They brought the crisis. They made sure they got bailed out before anybody else did. It's really disgusting, and the country knows it. This is the time to say to people, you do have an option called a credit union, which is a much more community-oriented, socially responsible institution. Public banking would be, in a way, a credit union for us all. And that would be a wonderful benefit. And now I think is a time when people are questioning and backing away from the big private banks for all kinds of reasons. They're wondering where to go. Public banking is an important alternative to offer people. And I think we will be easily able to convince the rest of the country of what the folks of North Dakota have known for a century, that a big public bank is a big public asset. All right, Alan, thank you very much. And thanks to everyone at the Public Banking Institute for the work you do, which is something we all build on and can relate to and applaud.
That was Professor Richard Wolff, praising the Bank of North Dakota. Established in 1919 and thriving today, it is the only state-owned, state-run general service bank in the United States. Richard Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus at UMass Amherst and a visiting professor in the New School University in New York City. He's a founder of Democracy at Work and host of their nationally syndicated show, Economic Update. Among Ellen Brown's 12 books is The Public Bank Solution. Here she traces the history and evolution of the current private banking system, showing how it took the power to create money away from the public and how people can take that power back through public banks that operate in the public interest. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.